Good morning and welcome to the Thursday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Americans are really bad at drawing these three states, by Chris Wilson. Last week, we challenged readers to draw the outlines of all 50 states and Washington, D.C. from memory, and then graded each attempt using an algorithm to measure how closely each submission resembled the correct shape. Based on over 2 million submissions, we're now able to measure which states were the hardest and which were the easiest. While some of the results were what we expected, other states were surprisingly confounding. As you might guess, the easiest state was Colorado, where 93% of participants scored at least a B and usually an A or A+. Colorado is almost a perfect rectangle when one uses the common map projection used in web applications. Hawaii's archipelago was the most difficult, also unsurprising, but the next two were curious. Participants had a lot of difficulty with Maryland, which hugs the cap of Virginia and wraps around the top of the Chesapeake Bay. They also struggled with Michigan, which most of us can picture as a mitten-shaped state. Some people used a right-handed mitten instead of the correct left-handed one, and many forgot the Upper Peninsula, which is larger than many people think. While we expected Alaska to be the hardest, it was actually fourth. Congressman attacked by gunman leaves intensive care, by Alan Fram for the Associated Press in Washington. House Majority Whip Steve Scalise, grievously wounded in a shooting at a baseball practice nearly a month ago, has been moved out of the intensive care unit of a Washington hospital but remains in serious condition. The Louisiana congressman and third-ranking House Republican underwent surgery last week at MedStar Washington Hospital Center and is being treated for infection, according to an official familiar with his condition. The official spoke on condition of anonymity to freely discuss Scalise's condition. Scalise and four other people were injured June 14th when a gunman opened fire on a practice in nearby Alexandria, Virginia. U.S. Capitol Police and other officers returned fire and killed the gunman. The 51-year-old congressman was struck in the hip and the bullet tore into blood vessels, bones, and internal organs. Police searching for armed man in Alabama after shooting, by the Associated Press in Gardendale, Alabama. Authorities searched for an armed man Wednesday following a shooting at an Alabama mobile home community near Birmingham. Gardendale police released a photo of a potential suspect in a Facebook post and told residents to stay inside while they looked for a man described as an active shooter. Birmingham area news outlets reported three people had been killed, but police didn't immediately return messages seeking comment. The search for a man police identified as Kenneth Dion Lever, 52, of Pensacola, Florida, initially focused in woods near the Peachtree Crossings mobile home community, but police later said they believed he'd left the area. Lever might be in a black Lincoln Navigator with a Florida license plate, police said. A worker who answered the phone at the mobile home community declined comment, citing instructions from law enforcement. Court records show a judge issued an order in December telling Lever to stay away from ex-wife Dana Lever and their daughter, a juvenile. Dana Lever sought the protective order, claiming the man was stalking and harassing them, records show. Separately, charges against Lever involving sexual abuse of a minor were filed in York County, Pennsylvania, according to the request from Dana Lever. A hearing in the Alabama case is scheduled for July 26th, a court docket showed. This is United's new plan to deal with overbooked flights, by Lucinda Shen. United Airlines' public image has plummeted over the past few months, a decline that began in April when the company forcibly removed a passenger from a flight due to what some considered a form of overbooking. Now the company is trying to make oversold flights less of a problem. According to Bloomberg, United is set to unveil a system whereby the airline would offer rewards to passengers who are willing to give up their seat on an overbooked flight days in advance. With United's new Flex Schedule program, created in partnership with startup Volantio, the airline will send emails to passengers with a header such as, "Are you flexible with your travels to Los Angeles?" ahead of their flight. If the passenger responds yes, then the traveler could be rebooked within 24 hours of responding for a different flight on the same day and via the same airports. In return, United will offer the passenger a $250 travel voucher. United and other airlines have long offered cash or frequent flyer miles to passengers on board overbooked airplanes who are willing to surrender their seat. A similar offer was made on board an April United flight, but nobody took the deal. That led to Dr. David Dow being dragged off the plane after he was randomly selected to be bumped by a computer system. Starbucks is giving out free iced teas. Here's how to get them. By Lisa Marie Segarra. Starbucks is giving out its new Teavana iced teas for free Friday, but for a very limited time. The coffee chain is giving customers a taste of the new tea line during its Free Tea Friday on July 14th. But the offer only lasts from 1 to 2 p.m. and is only available at locations in the United States and Canada. Only tall or 12 fluid ounces sizes will be offered for free. The new drinks were released on July 11th. The Teavana Shaken Iced Tea Infusions feature a tea, fruit, and botanical blend, and they're made without any artificial flavors or sweeteners. You get more of a true tea experience when you flavor green, white, or black tea with herbal tea made from botanicals and fruit, Starbucks product developer Melinda Chang said in a release. The drinks will be available year-round at participating Starbucks locations and select licensed stores. They include pineapple black tea, peach citrus white tea, and strawberry green tea flavors. A Brief History of U.S. Presidential Struggles with North Korea by Emma Tolkoff. When it comes to North Korean diplomacy, U.S. presidents have long been faced with a number of choices, none of them particularly good. "You're not choosing between good and bad," says Victor Cha, former director of Asian affairs for the White House National Security Council under George W. Bush. "You're choosing between bad, really bad, worse, and much worse options." Since the 1990s, presidential approaches have ranged from reconciliatory to openly unfriendly. But truly effective diplomacy remains elusive, and an aggressive military approach has been seen largely as a last resort, since it could provoke nuclear violence or an attack on Seoul. There have been a number of key differences in approach. Then-President Clinton made a number of visible attempts at negotiating with North Korea, including sending then-Secretary of State Madeleine Albright to North Korea for an official state visit in 2000. In contrast, George W. Bush took what RAND senior international defense researcher Bruce Bennett characterizes as a more hands-offish approach to negotiations, largely because of ideological opposition to the North Korean regime's human rights abuses. Bush famously placed North Korea into an axis of evil along with Iran and Iraq in his 2002 State of the Union address. And following rejected negotiation offers and increased nuclear testing, Obama would eventually settle into a policy of strategic patience bolstered by a looming threat of nuclear retaliation. "The rhetoric between the administrations emphasizes difference," says Jeffrey Lewis, an expert on nuclear strategy at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies. "But that popular narrative is a little misleading," say Lewis and other experts on the region. "In fact, the policies are really similar. There are differences, but there's a lot more continuity and dysfunction than people really present," Lewis says. North Korea experts say they see U.S. presidents making similar mistakes over and over, missteps that may stem from a misunderstanding of the Kim regime. Cha, who served as a U.S. delegate at the 2003 six-party talks aimed at negotiating North Korean deproliferation, points out that even in the face of bipartisan agreement over goals in North Korea, U.S. attempts have fallen flat because traditional means of negotiation and control are simply not effective there. One such strategy is reliance on sanctions. Since the Bush era, the U.S. has imposed economic sanctions against North Korea aimed at stifling their nuclear program. Those measures were further tightened under the Obama administration following the fourth in a series of nuclear tests that North Korea has launched since 2006. But sanctions rarely have meaningful impact on the nuclear program itself. And for a nation that went through debilitating famine in the 90s, a disaster that claimed the lives of as many as 3 million people, largely because of state policies, it can be difficult for sanctions to sway the government, even if they affect the economic health of the country's citizens, says Bennett. Secondly, negotiations attempts have fallen flat because of North Korean dealings. Over the past few decades, North Korea has consistently reneged on arms agreements, hindering U.S. presidents' efforts to stitch together a truce. Throughout 1994, the U.S. participated in a series of negotiations culminating in the agreed framework under which North Korea agreed to freeze proliferation and replace its nuclear power reactors with proliferation-resistant light water reactors. In a speech, Clinton lauded the agreement as a crucial step toward drawing North Korea into the global community. But just a few years later, it became clear that North Korea had been consistently violating the terms of the agreement since its inception, and the framework disintegrated. Similarly, an Obama-brokered deal in 2012, the Leap Day Agreement, dissolved in just a few weeks after a satellite launch attempt from Pyongyang. The fact that those deals quickly dissolved, say experts, is evidence of a regime and a culture that views negotiations as a means to temporary truce and agreements as non-binding. These repeated frustrations have led presidents stretching back several administrations to consistently end up pushing the issue off, something that may no longer be possible now that the nation possesses an ICBM. There are just such limitations that most of the presidents have eventually turned to something akin to strategic patience. We're going to kick this can down the road, says Bennett. But that doesn't mean that the playing field itself hasn't changed. In the mid-90s, when the problem was on then-President Clinton's plate, for example, North Korea had only a handful of very crude weapons, says Cha. Now, more than 20 years and five nuclear tests later, the stakes have changed, and that means that Trump may have to break the pattern that's held for the last few administrations. This issue has been a can kicked down the road for some time, and it's really his problem now, Cha said. He's the one who has to deal with it now in a way that no president has had to before. Was Donald Trump Jr.'s Russia meeting illegal? Here's what experts say, by Tessa Berenson. Critics of Donald Trump Jr.'s decision to meet with a Russian lawyer offering damaging evidence about Hillary Clinton have accused him of collusion, but it's not at all clear whether President Trump's eldest son actually broke any laws. Collusion is a vague term and is not itself a federal crime. Whether Trump Jr. broke any laws depends on the nature of his cooperation with Russia, if any, and whether he impeded any investigations into the matter. No law enforcement officials have accused Trump Jr. of committing a crime, and he has publicly denied having done anything wrong. Here are four legal areas that are under public debate regarding the president's eldest son agreeing to accept opposition research from a foreign power. Campaign finance. Trump Jr. could have run afoul of campaign finance law if Russia was offering an illegal campaign contribution that he agreed to accept. To be considered an illegal campaign contribution, what Russia offered must be considered of value as defined by campaign finance law. There are reasons to question whether simply exchanging information with a foreign national would count. Having meetings and discussions with foreign representatives or foreign countries is not itself regulated, says Jan Barron, a partner at Wiley Rhine. And in fact, the FEC has for decades acknowledged that a foreign national who may not make a campaign expenditure under law may be a volunteer for a campaign. In the past, the FEC has approved foreign nationals to work as unpaid volunteers on campaigns and allowed a congressman's wife who was a member of the Guatemalan parliament to campaign with him, Barron says. Everyone's upset that Don Jr. met with Russians, says Barron, but I don't see where there's a violation of campaign finance laws, let alone a conspiracy to violate those laws. But other election law experts disagree. Robert Bauer, White House counsel to former President Barack Obama from 2009 to 2011, explained to New York why he thinks the information Russia offered Trump Jr. could be considered of value under the law. The Russian lawyer, Natalia Veselnitskaya, said the campaign wanted that material or wanted negative information on Hillary Clinton very badly, said Bauer. An important part of the Trump campaign strategy was to create major doubts about Hillary Clinton, and so any material that somebody could acquire that would dramatically support those claims was of exceptional value to the campaign. If Bauer is right, then some argue that he could be in legal jeopardy even if the meeting didn't result in any valuable information changing hands, as Trump Jr. has claimed. The fact that he met with her is an overt act that may support criminal intent, Notre Dame University law professor Jimmy Garulli told USA Today. Ignorance of the law is no defense. Obstruction of justice. Trump Jr. could find himself in trouble not just over the meeting itself, but for his shifting accounts of how it transpired. Did I meet with people that were Russian? I'm sure I did, Donald Trump Jr. told The Times in March. But none that were set up, none that I can think of at the moment, and certainly none that I was representing the campaign in any way, shape, or form. Then, he said, the meeting was only about an old program involving American adoptions of Russian children. Then he admitted he invited both campaign manager Paul Manafort and top campaign aide Jared Kushner to sit in on the meeting, knowing they would discuss information about Clinton. Lying to the public or to the media is generally not a crime, thanks to the broad free speech protections of the First Amendment. But if Trump Jr. provides shifting or untruthful explanations to the investigators probing links between the Trump campaign and Russia, he could be charged with providing false statements or obstructing justice, both of which are crimes. Treason. Virginia Senator Tim Kaine, Clinton's former running mate, said Tuesday that Trump Jr.'s actions had risen to potentially treason. As the only crime defined in the Constitution, treason is a serious offense, but it's also rarely prosecuted. There have been just 30 treason trials in the U.S. since 1789, according to the Constitution Center. In Section 3 of Article 3, the Constitution reads, "Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act or on confession in open court." It's not clear whether Russia is an enemy of the U.S. as defined by the treason clause. The answer is probably not. The two countries have a generally adversarial relationship, but the U.S. is not in a declared war with Russia, which means that Trump Jr.'s actions would likely not be considered treasonous. For purposes of American treason law, the details of Donald Trump Jr.'s relationship with Russia are irrelevant, writes Carlton F.W. Larson in the Washington Post. He could be a paid foreign agent of Russia. He could take an oath of allegiance to Russia. He could even bug his father's White House bedroom on behalf of Russian intelligence. None of those actions would amount to treason in the narrow sense that our Constitution defines it. The Logan Act. The Logan Act of 1799 bars citizens from engaging in any correspondence or intercourse with any foreign government with intent to influence the measures or conduct of any foreign government in relation to any disputes or controversies with the United States. But the Logan Act has never been successfully used, according to Steve Vladek at Lawfare. The last indictment under the Act took place more than 200 years ago. There's a legal doctrine called desuetude that says statutes may lapse if they're never enforced, making it even more far-fetched that the Logan Act could be employed against Trump Jr. With reporting by Massimo Calabresi. A widow wrote this searing rage defense of Patton Oswalt's engagement by Erica Roman. Roman writes about loss and healing at ericaroman.me. This article originally appeared on Erica Roman's blog on July 7, 2017. Yesterday, I was very excited to see that the comedian Patton Oswalt had announced his engagement to Meredith Salinger. Now, anyone who knows me knows that I don't follow the lives of celebrities at all. I've made an exception for him. Our spouses both unexpectedly died within 3 days of each other, and both of us have processed our grief journey fairly openly. Of course, his platform is a mite bigger than mine, LOL. On the 102nd day of his journey, 105 for me, he wrote in a Facebook post, "I was face down and frozen for weeks. It's 102 days later, and I can confidently say I've reached a point where I'm crawling, which, objectively, is an improvement. Maybe 102 days later, I'll be walking." I shared that post on my own page because I could connect to that place he was in. No longer frozen, but the crawling was so painful. Well, it's been 442 days for him now, and it makes my heart happy to see that his heart has continued to move forward, that it has healed and expanded to the place where he can now love another. My happiness for him quickly shifted to indignant anger on his behalf as I began to read the comments under the article. "Nope, too soon. It's none of my business, and I'm glad they're all happy, but all the hair stands on the back of my neck when this happens." Comment after comment like that poured out judgment and disdain. It made me sick. I had to stop reading before I gave in to the temptation to rain fire in response to every comment. Instead, I decided to address them here all at once. So, my dear, ignorant, judgmental a-holes, this one is for you. You aren't entitled to an opinion. You don't get to comment on the choices of a widower while you sit happily next to your own living spouse. You didn't have to stand and watch your mundane morning turn into your absolute worst nightmare. You didn't have to face the agony of despair as the only person who could possibly bring you comfort had been ripped from your life forever. You didn't have to stand in the ashes of what was once your life, when the sun itself darkened and the very air you breathed felt toxic in your lungs. Go back to scrolling Facebook and keep your ignorance to yourself. Who gave you the position to judge when it's too soon for a person who has suffered the worst to be able to find happiness and companionship again? It's been 15 months. How long should a widow sit in isolation before you are comfortable enough to release them from their solitary confinement? Because it's really about you, isn't it? You aren't actually concerned about the heart of the person who has found the strength and courage to love once more. You're worried about your own offended sensibilities rooted in old Victorian traditions. Stop pretending you're actually concerned about their healing. And it does take strength and courage to imply that it is weakness that drives someone who has lost their spouse to choose to love again is asinine. Unlike most, those who have been widowed are hyper-aware that everyone they see will someday die. We know intimately that the price of love is pain. So if you see a widow or widower overcome that knowledge and choose to open their heart to that pain once again, instead of judging, you should be celebrating their bravery and fortitude. That much courage deserves a freaking parade. And another thing, the person who comes after cannot and will not replace the one we lost. To imply that is insulting to the widow, it's insulting to the new love, and it's insulting to the love who was lost. Earlier, I said that I was happy to see Patton Oswalt's heart had expanded. I use that word intentionally. I say expanded because that's what widowed hearts do. They expand. One love isn't moved out to make room for someone new. An addition is built. Just like my love for my daughter was not diminished by the birth of my son, so too the love widows can have for someone new does not diminish the love of the one lost. The expansion of the heart is part of the grieving process. We've gone through hellfire and lived. We don't need your negativity in our lives. So please, if what you have to say about a widow or widower finding love again isn't supportive and encouraging, then keep it to yourself. We aren't interested in hearing it. P.S. Mr. Oswalt, if this somehow gets to you, from one widow to another, I'd like to say congratulations from the bottom of my heart. I am so incredibly happy for you, and I hope I am just as lucky someday. Editor's note, Oswald read this piece and wrote the following on Facebook on July 8th. This is so amazing and so well written. I expected some bitter grubworms to weigh in anonymously, always, 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 with their much-needed opinions when I announced my engagement last week, and I decided to ignore them. But yeah, I felt this rage, and Erica articulated it better than I could have ever hoped. So there you go. Thank you, Erica. Four men went missing in Pennsylvania in the last week. Here's What to Know by Mahita Gajanan. Four Pennsylvania men have gone missing in the last week, prompting an extensive investigation from local and state authorities along with the FBI. The men, all between the ages of 18 and 22, went missing over the course of 2 days in Bucks County, a suburb of Philadelphia. Authorities have said foul play is suspected in the missing cases. Here's What to Know about their disappearance. Who are the men who disappeared? Jimmy Tar Patrick, 19, was the first to go missing. Patrick was last seen at about 6 p.m. on Wednesday in Newtown Township and did not show up at his job the next day, the New York Times reported, citing authorities. The next two men to disappear were Mark Sturgis, 22, and his friend Tom Mio, 21, who were last seen around 6 p.m. on Friday. Neither men arrived at their construction jobs the next day. The Times reports that their cell phones went straight to voicemail when dialed. The fourth person to vanish was Dean Fianicario, 18, who was last seen in Middletown Township about 6:30 p.m. on Friday. What has the investigation found? The search for the four missing men led authorities to scour a breadth of farmland in Solbury Township, which is located about 30 miles north of Philadelphia. Authorities searched the farm after a signal from Fiancario's cell phone led them there, the Times reported. Law enforcement officials searched the 68-acre farm using a ton of investigative resources, Buck County District Attorney Matthew Weintraub said in a news conference on Monday. According to the Times, police also found Sturgis's car at an outdoor shopping mall. Weintraub, when asked if foul play was involved, said during the news conference, "It sure would seem so. We've been treating this from the outset as a criminal investigation, and nothing has deterred that from this point," he said. "We are not sure what we're going to find there, but we're pretty confident that the investigation is proceeding in the direction that we believed that it would." In a news conference on Tuesday, Weintraub said about 40 or 50 people are searching more than 90 acres. Are there any suspects? Not yet. Police on Monday arrested Cosmo DiNardo, 20, whose family owns the farm in Solbury Township that authorities searched. DiNardo was arrested on an unrelated gun charge, the Associated Press reported, and authorities have not called him a suspect in the disappearances. DiNardo is a person of interest in the investigation, Weintraub said on Tuesday. He also confirmed that DiNardo's parents own the farm, which is the main search site. The AP, citing an affidavit procured by the Bucks County Courier-Times, reported that DiNardo was accused of having a shotgun and ammunition in February, even though he has a history of mental illness that has included voluntary commitment. DiNardo was held on $1 million bail in Bucks County Jail. The Times reports that police searched DiNardo's home in Bensalem, which is about 30 miles from his parents' property.
This film critic denounced the Bechdel test, and the internet is not having it, by Oliver Gettle. Film critic Kyle Smith is facing fierce criticism online for railing against the Bechdel test, a benchmark of whether a movie portrays women as fully formed characters, and for claiming that men dominate Hollywood because they're more inclined to tell stories about extreme characters. Created by the cartoonist Alison Bechdel 32 years ago, the Bechdel test asks whether a film includes at least two named female characters who have a conversation with each other on screen that is not about a male character. Although the test has tongue-in-cheek origins, it nonetheless underscores the dearth of multidimensional female characters in mainstream movies. Smith, a staunch conservative voice for the New York Post and National Review, denounced the Bechdel test in the latter publication Monday, writing it off as a feminist litmus test that measures the political correctness of a film. Smith argued the Bechdel test is as arbitrary as a hypothetical cowboy test, which would evaluate whether movies feature cowboys in them. He also wrote that, quote, "Movies aren't intended to be a proper demographic cross-section of America. Movies, at least Hollywood movies, are about people on the extremes of society. Cops, criminals, superheroes. These extreme characters tend to be men, and men tend to be the ones who create them," unquote. Smith further suggested that women's movie ideas aren't commercial enough for Hollywood studios because women tend to write movies about relationships and men tend to write movies about aliens and shootouts. Smith's takedown was slammed on social media by many readers who disagreed with his assessment of the Bechdel test and felt he missed the point. Quote, "The Bechdel test isn't meant to be like the sole method for judging movies," tweeted Sean McElwee, a political analyst. "It forces us to think more deliberately about sexism and art," unquote. Quote, "There are over 3.5 billion women in the world, and movies consistently fail to portray them simply talking to each other," another Twitter user wrote. Several readers also mocked Smith's comparison of women and cowboys. "Ah, yes, cowboys that underrepresented 50% of the population," one wrote. More reactions to Smith's piece follow. Tweet, Ashley Perez, "For everyone trying to name good films that are exceptions to passing the Bechdel test, you are missing the point." Jessica Ellis, "So let me just talk the Bechdel test and the nonsensical article by Kyle Smith a tad. The issue the test addresses is erasure and agency." Jessica Ellis followed with, "It's not that movies that show two women talking only about dudes are always bad. No one, literally no one, has said that." Jessica Ellis followed up again with, "It's that when you look at the vast spectrum of movies and there is an overwhelmingly similar portrayal of women, it's worth looking into." Tom Petty, "How poor would your opinion of women have to be to compare their actual underrepresentation on film to that of hypothetical cowboys, LMAO? Chad Bailey, "Sadly, I wouldn't be surprised to find out that more films pass the cowboy test than the Bechdel test." And David Joyce, "You should skip the idiotic Bechdel article. It's too inane. It's just trolling."
President Trump is visiting Paris on Bastille Day. Here's Why That Matters by Rachel Lewis. U.S. President Donald Trump is traveling to France Wednesday evening to meet new French President Emmanuel Macron and to celebrate Bastille Day. The two leaders are expected to discuss issues like counterterrorism and the war in Syria, but may skip topics where they disagree, like climate change and trade. This year's Bastille Day will be particularly poignant for the French people, as it marks exactly 1 year since a deadly terrorist attack that left 86 people dead and hundreds wounded in the city of Nice. Here's what to know about Bastille Day and President Trump's trip to France. Known to the French simply as 14 Juillet, Bastille Day is a national holiday celebrating the 1789 storming of the Bastille, an event widely regarded to have kick-started the French Revolution. The Bastille was a fortress that was used by the kings of France as a state prison. Over the years, it became seen by many as a symbol of monarchical tyranny. Armed crowds attacked the Bastille at dawn on July 14, 1789. Prison General René Jourdain de Launay surrendered, but was later murdered by an angry mob despite attempts to try him in court. All seven prisoners being held at the Bastille at the time were freed. The dramatic event inspired a wave of revolutionary fever among France's lower socioeconomic classes. Exactly 1 year after the storming of the Bastille, the French celebrated the Fête de la Fédération, which aimed to symbolize peace and unity during the French Revolution. In the space of a year, the state had abolished feudalism and adopted the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of Citizen, a constitution intended to protect French citizens' equality, freedom of speech, and political representation. Bastille Day is always celebrated on July 14th. It has been a French national holiday since 1880, when the chairman of the French Senate addressed the chamber to say, "Do not forget that behind this 14 July where victory of the new era over the Ancien Régime was bought by fighting, do not forget that after the day of 14 July 1789, there was a day of 14 July 1790. Similar to America's 4th of July, Bastille Day is seen as a celebration of being French. France starts the day with the world's oldest and largest military parade. Held in Paris since 1880, the massively attended event involves around 4,000 military personnel and police marching down the iconic Champs-Élysées. Bastille Day is also a public holiday in France, meaning businesses and schools are closed. Cities around the country also host parties, concerts, and fireworks displays. Francophiles in countries across the world also celebrate the event. Macron invited Trump to visit France for the Bastille Day celebrations during a June phone call between the two leaders in preparation for the recent G20 summit. It's for France a unique opportunity to show French military power, and that's very important for Trump, Alexandra Duhoup-Scheffer, director of the German Marshall Fund's Paris office, told Reuters. The president will arrive in Paris early on Thursday morning. He will be welcomed by a ceremony at Les Invalides, view Napoleon's tomb, and visit a French war museum. Trump and Macron will then have a meeting followed by a joint press conference. NBC News reported that activists from a group calling itself Paris Against Trump are planning to protest Trump's visit to Paris. On Thursday, they will set up a no-Trump zone in the Place de la République and will then lead a Bastille Day march through the city center.
My loyalty is to the Constitution. Trump's FBI nominee pledges agency independence. By unknown author. Christopher Wray, President Donald Trump's pick to head the FBI after he ousted James Comey from the position 2 months ago, headed to Congress Wednesday for his confirmation hearing. Appearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee, Wray pledged to retain the independence of the agency and ensure it remains above the partisan fray, which was expected to be a key line of questioning during the hearing. Quote, "If I am given the honor of leading this agency, I will never allow the FBI's work to be driven by anything other than the facts, the law, and the impartial pursuit of justice, period," he said. "My loyalty is to the Constitution and the rule of law. They have been my guidepost throughout my career, and I will continue to adhere to them no matter the test," unquote. FBI directors are typically nominated for decade-long terms in order to provide some immunity against the partisanship of electoral politics. But the position of a permanent FBI director has remained vacant since Trump abruptly fired Comey in May. Comey's former deputy, Andrew McCabe, has been filling in as acting director. Quote, "It's vitally important for the FBI to remain independent," said Senator Chuck Grassley, chairman of the Judiciary Committee. He expressed confidence in Wray's ability to retain that independence. Wray's testimony comes amidst intensified scrutiny surrounding the investigation into possible collusion between Russia and Trump associates during the 2016 campaign, and is on the heels of Donald Trump Jr.'s acknowledgement that he met with a Russian lawyer during the campaign to receive compromising information about Hillary Clinton. Comey confirmed in March that the FBI was investigating Russian interference in the election, including possibilities of collusion. In his congressional testimony last month, he detailed conversations he had with the president, who he said had asked him for complete loyalty, a request he demurred, and said he had asked his friend to provide that report to the New York Times in the hopes of appointing a special prosecutor. One day after the Times ran that report in May, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein appointed Robert Mueller as special prosecutor to oversee the investigation in an effort to ensure independence and impartiality. Wray is no newcomer to Washington. He served for nearly half a decade in the Justice Department during the George W. Bush administration before joining the law firm King & Spalding, where he currently works. Democrats are expected to grill him about his time in the Bush administration and what he knew about the torture memos, the controversial 2002 documents that gave Bush the authority to order enhanced interrogation techniques without being charged for war crimes. An insanely massive iceberg just broke off of Antarctica. By Danica Kirka. A vast iceberg with twice the volume of Lake Erie has broken off from a key floating ice shelf in Antarctica, scientists said Wednesday. The iceberg broke off from the Larsen C ice shelf, scientists at the University of Swansea in Britain said. The iceberg is described as weighing 1 trillion tons, 1.12 trillion U.S. tons. The process, known as calving, occurred in the last few days when a 5,800 square kilometer or 2,240 square mile section broke away. Quote, "We have been anticipating this event for months and have been surprised how long it took for the rift to break through the final few kilometers of ice," said Adrian Luckman of Swansea University. "We will continue to monitor both the impact of this calving event on the Larsen C ice shelf and the fate of this huge iceberg." "It was a natural event that wasn't caused by man-made climate change," said Swansea glaciologist Martin O'Leary. "Nonetheless, this puts the ice shelf in a very vulnerable position," he said in a statement. Scientists said the latest iceberg break won't affect sea levels in the short term. NASA and European Space Agency satellites have been monitoring the shelf, offering dramatic pictures of the break that heightened interest beyond the scientific community. The final break was first revealed in a thermal infrared image from NASA's AquaMODIS satellite instrument. Scientists from the UK-based Antarctic Project MIDAS have been monitoring the rift in Larsen C for years, following earlier research on the collapse of the Larsen A shelf in 1995 and the breakup of the Larsen B shelf in 2002. The project, which is investigating the effects of a warming climate through a combination of fieldwork, satellite observation, and computer simulation, describes the iceberg as one of the largest ever recorded. The researchers suggest the iceberg is likely to break into fragments and say that while some of the ice may stay nearby for decades, parts of it may drift north into warmer waters. But researchers say much more study needs to be done to determine the cause. Quote, "At this point, it would be premature to say this was caused by global warming," said Anna Hogg of the Center for Polar Observation and Modeling at the University of Leeds.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.